Let's talk sports. This is Kent Batty, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, and I'll be reading to you today from the USA Today Sports Weekly, dated October 8th through the 14th. We'll start with the NFL week and 32 things we learned. 0. The number of wins for New York Jets rookie coach Aaron Glenn, whose team was embarrassed at home 37-22 by the Dallas Cowboys on Sunday. With Kellen Moore's New Orleans Saints getting off the mat against the Giants, Glenn is the only first-year coach among this year's 7 to remain winless, and his team is now the only one league-wide without a victory. Number 1, as in, who's the number one contender to win Super Bowl 60 after the defending champion Philadelphia Eagles lost their first game of the season a few hours before the previously unbeaten Buffalo Bills also went down? It seems like an unusually large field at the moment, given the number of questions that abound around the league. So, let's explore. 2. As in the number of losses Philly has now suffered over the last 365 days, the Eagles obviously remain a bona fide championship threat, yet they also have issues to address, particularly on offense. Wide receiver A.J. Brown had another quiet game, only 5 catches for 43 yards, and even running back Saquon Barkley undermined Philadelphia. On a day when he rushed for 30 yards on a mere 6 carries, Barkley also committed an illegal shift infraction that nullified a fourth down conversion in the fourth quarter and forced the team to punt on its penultimate possession. 2A. The Bills also remain right there, even if their icy, cold front uniforms won't get them closer to any championship ice at the season's end. The sky isn't falling in western New York, though the New England Patriots win there in the Saturday night football game was a clear announcement that the AFC East probably won't be a walkover for a change. 3. The number of wins for the Denver Broncos, who beat the Eagles for their first win in Philadelphia since 1986. That's 2 impressive victories in 6 days for Denver, which added 6 more sacks to what was already a league-leading total of 15 entering Week 5. And with quarterback Bo Nix belatedly settling into his second season, the Broncos look like a team that could make a deep run. 4. The number of 2024 first-team All-Pros, including quarterback Lamar Jackson, inactive for the spiraling Baltimore Ravens, who were crushed 44-10 at home by the Houston Texans. Now 1-4, their Super Bowl aspirations are in serious crisis, and the Ravens face the Rams in Week 6 before reaching a badly needed bye week. 5. The 34-point loss matched the Ravens' largest in Baltimore, the differential also equaling the Texans' most lopsided road win in their 24-season history. 6. The number of red zone touchdowns, in 6 attempts no less, scored by the Indianapolis Colts in their 40-6 beatdown of the Las Vegas Raiders. Still feels like a stretch to consider Indy a bona fide championship contender, but a 4-1 squad is increasingly taking on the look of a potential division titleist. And yes, the AFC South counts. 7. In an odd turnabout to that game, the Colts played most of the day without injured kicker Spencer Schrader, forcing them to attempt 4 consecutive 2-point conversions in the blowout. Meanwhile, the Raiders lost punter A.J. Cole, forcing kicker Daniel Carlson into his role. 8. The number of times the Texans scored at Baltimore, which also coincided with the number of drives played by quarterback C.J. Stroud, whose 4 TD passes were one shy of his career high. With 2 consecutive wins following an 0-3 start, Houston is re-emerging as a team that could win a 3rd straight division title. And yes, the AFC South counts. 9. The game of the day also featured the best throwback uniforms of the day. The Tampa Bay Buccaneers beating the Seattle Seahawks at the gun 38-35 in a fitting celebration of 2 organizations in the midst of their 50th NFL season. Could it have been an NFC Championship preview? Very well within the realm of possibility, despite surprising Seattle's defensive letdown. Number 10. The Bucks aren't blowing anyone out, all four of their victories occurring on game-winning scores in the final minute of regulation, something no team has ever done on the way to its first four wins. The perennial NFC South camps remain a resilient bunch that can beat you in a variety of ways. 11. How about the matchup of former Ohio State first-round wideouts in Seattle? The Bucks, nay, Bucks, Emeka Egbuka, and Seahawks Jackson Smith Njigba combined for 15 catches, 295 yards, and a TD apiece. 12. The Cowboys, mostly wearing white, and Jets, mostly wearing black, provided the worst-looking game of the day, visually and stylistically. 21 combined penalties, that is. 13. How crazy has the scoring been so far? There have been 14 40-burgers posted this season, already the most through 5 weeks since the 1970 AFL-NFL merger. And week 5 wasn't done yet, pending the Monday Night Football contest. Unfortunately, folks, I don't remember that score. 14. As in tied for 14th place all time with 173 regular season wins. That's where Denver coach Sean Payton stands after the Broncos win, which broke a tie between him and his mentor, Hall of Famer Bill Parcells. Payton is now deadlocked with Jeff Fisher and Ravens coach John Harbaugh, whose team doesn't appear as if it's going to keep up the pace with Payton's Broncos, not in the near term anyway. Mike McCarthy is alone in 13th place for now with 174 wins. How about Carolina Panthers? This is number 16. How about Carolina Panthers running back Ricky Dowdle? That's rather Rico Dowdle, who rushed for a league-wide season-high 206 yards in relief of injured starter Chuba Hubbard in his team's 27-24 defeat of the Miami Dolphins. 17. Still boggles the mind that the Cowboys didn't re-sign Dowdle, who rushed for nearly 1,100 yards last year, or that no other team saw fit to offer him even $3 million for 2025, though he could eclipse that figure by reaching certain escalators. Heck, even Jerry Jones would be willing to pay that. 18. The jury number, one that might be retired one day, of Minnesota Vikings wide receiver Justin Jefferson. With 123 receiving yards in the defeat of the Browns in London, Jettis now has 7,881 in his career, third most by a player in his first six seasons. And he still has 12 games to play in a bid to overtake Randy Moss's standard, 8,375 yards, over a half dozen years. 19. The L.A. Chargers might have lost some juice lately, but don't blame veteran wide receiver Keenan Allen. Making his 159th career appearance, he hauled in his 1,000th career catch, 8 games quicker than Hall of Famer Marvin Harrison, who previously set the standard for speed to that benchmark. Number 20. Minus both of their starting offensive tackles, the Bolts seem to be reverting to title pretender, and quite likely the third best team in the AFC West after suffering a second straight loss. 21. The Chargers' defeat came courtesy of the Washington Commanders, who had quarterback Jaden Daniels back in the lineup. Yet the emergence of rookie running back Jacory Bill-Kroski-Merritt, who had a career day, 5 games into his career anyway, with 150 yards and 2 TDs from scrimmage, could be the key to returning the Commanders to the league's elite ranks, to the degree they never ever really left. Number 22. Would the Cincinnati Bengals just to trade for Giants quarterback 3 Jameis Winston already? 23. But not really a surprise that the Jake Browning-led Stripes couldn't handle the Detroit Lions, who also have an increasingly strong case to supplant Philly atop the league throne, with a 4-game heater erasing memories of their week 1 flop at Green Bay. Detroit got TDs. This is number 24, folks. Detroit got TDs from running backs Jahmyr Gibbs and David Montgomery, the 14th time both have scored in the same game, tying Emmitt Smith and Darrell Johnston for the most games among running back teammates, each scoring a touchdown in the Super Bowl era, that is, since 1966. Number 25. The Los Angeles Rams didn't win Thursday, October 2nd, but wide receiver Puka Nacua caught 10 balls, giving him 52 receptions this season, most ever by a player after five games. Nacua bypassed his former teammate, Cooper Kupp, who had 49 grabs at the same point in 2022. Number 26. These might be the early stages of what could be an historic year for Nacua, who is on pace to snag 177 balls, which would smash the NFL single-season record at 149, established by Michael Thomas 6 years ago, and that was in 16 games. Nacua could also become the first-ever 2,000-yard receiver. He's currently on pace for 1,999 yards. 27. Dylan Gabriel became the Cleveland Browns' 41st quarterback won since their 1999 rebirth, but the first in the NFL to make his starting debut in an international series game. He was solid in London, but didn't do quite enough to guide Cleveland past the Minnesota Vikings. Number 28. Meanwhile, the Vikes improved to 5-0 all-time in London, though their 0-1 record in Dublin made their two-week European vacation something of a wash. 29. But Minnesota did make a bit of history in the old country, thanks to wide receiver Jordan Addison's game-winning TD catch with 25 seconds on the clock. The victory was the first ever played internationally to feature a decisive TB in the final minute of regulation of overtime. Number 30. When will NFL players, especially ones running free to pay dirt, learn to keep the ball secured until they cross the goal line? Arizona Cardinals running back Amare DeMicardo, whose team really needed him to show up after losing James Conner and Trey Benson to injuries, was the latest to dump the rock prematurely. His would-be 72-yard TD bolt, instead of a 71-yard run, punctuated by a turnover, one that led to his team's downfall against the previously winless Tennessee Titans. 31. Second to last, but not penultimately at least, congratulations to Titans quarterback Cam Ward, the number one pick of this year's draft, who notched his first career win at DeMarcado's expense. We sass. 32. Last, but not least, congratulations to Saints quarterback Spencer Rattler. We've noted more than once the bagel he's carried for more than a year in his personal NFL win column, but he got his first and his 11th professional start in the defeat of the Giants. Now let's turn to another NFL special interest story written by Nate Davis. For decades now, it seems like the Buffalo Bills and New England Patriots have been ships passing in the void, which is typically what the AFC East is otherwise. But the Pats' 23-20 upset win Sunday night in Orchard Park in front of a primetime television audience offers fresh promise that these two franchises might finally be headed for a potentially entertaining collision course. It comes at a time when New England has some fresh protagonists. Second-year quarterback Drake May was nearly perfect after halftime, connecting on 13 of his 14 passes for 184 yards, and putting New England in position for Andy Borregales' game-winning field goal with 15 seconds to go, a 52-yarder that staked Buffalo the league's final unbeaten team. Seems May has learned a few things amid his growing personal relationship with Bills' counterpart and reigning league MVP Josh Allen. He's just the ultimate, May said of Allen last week. He wants the ball in his hands to win the game. With the game on the line, the ball is in Josh's hand a lot, and he ends up making the play. That's what I've learned, apparently. And if the former divisional rulers toppling the current ones wasn't enough, though Buffalo at 4-1 remains a game up on New England in the standings, there was also the return of expatriated and now repatriated wideout Stephon Diggs, the former Bills star playing in Western New York for the first time as a visitor, while catching 10 balls for 146 yards. It was lit, prime time, Diggs says. I've played here before, playing on the other side. It was electrifying. I knew it was going to be a test for us. It speaks volumes that we are taking steps in the right direction. There could be a lot more tests and steps ahead for a pair of franchises that have rarely been in serious conflict, despite being birthed together as divisional rivals in the AFL in 1960. The Patriots' social media team even attempted to light 65 years' worth of kindling by doctoring an image of Diggs side-eyeing Allen 18 months after their divorce. May himself took a playful shot at the Bills and their mantra, simply distilled years ago by Hall of Fame Buffalo coach Marv Levy. "Great environment playing the Buffalo Bills. Where else would you rather be?" May said after his team's win. "Good." As you may or may not recall, the Bills ruled the roost and the AFC at large in the first half of the 1990s, qualifying for a record 4 consecutive Super Bowls between 1990 and 1993. Then the Patriots emerged under coach Bill Parcells, reaching the Super Bowl themselves to end the 1996 campaign, before blossoming into perhaps the league's greatest ever dynasty with Bill Belichick and quarterback Tom Brady during the first two decades of the 21st century. Then Brady left for Tampa, and Allen's Bills awoke from their long cold winter, claiming New England's erstwhile throne, and now in pursuit of a sixth consecutive AFC crown, unless the Bills are unexpectedly usurped. With little evidence that the New York Jets or Miami Dolphins are anywhere close to their occasional spasms of relevance, it appears, spasms of relevance, I like that. It appears the Patriots are approaching a resurrection led by May and first-year coach Mike Vrabel. As a player, the former linebacker, along with Brady, Belichick, and all others, helped keep the Bills basically dead and buried for the 17 seasons preceding head coaches Sean McDermott's arrival in 2017. Allen was drafted a year later. Sunday night marked the Patriots' first win at Buffalo since a quirky windswept game in 2021, when then New England quarterback Mac Jones attempted three passes in a 14-10 victory, and following it, McDermott wanted no part of hearing what a brilliant tactician Belichick was. And by that point, the Patriots had largely abdicated anyway, which was quite evident when the brief Jones-Belichick edition was dismissed 47-10 in their playoff return to Highmark Stadium just a month later. What could be different moving forward in that the prime years of Allen and his quasi-football clone May could actually overlap when both are at or near their peaks? That was never really the case for Jim Kelly and Drew Bledsoe, or for Brady and Allen, or even Bledsoe and Brady, occasionally teammates in Foxborough and briefly adversaries later. Though Bledsoe ultimately finished 1-5 against the Pats, who drafted him atop the 1993 draft, and paid him exorbitantly until Belichick, correctly and unceremoniously, kicked the injured quarterback to the curb in 2001, when Brady went on to lead the franchise to the first of its six Lombardi trophies. Bledsoe was exiled to Buffalo months later. But it's New England that's morphed into a football version of Siberia in recent years, and now it's the Patriots who want to come in from the cold. What Coach Vrabel says is that where we want to go, where we want to be at, is where the Bills have been in the last couple of years. Contenders, winning the division and playing well at home, May said last week. So it's a tough environment, and like I said, they're a great football team with some great players. So we've got our hands full, but we're excited. The rest of the football universe should be, too, especially during a season when rivalries like Ravens versus Steelers or Chiefs versus the universe might not have quite the same juice. I think it's important that we can take the next step, show that we are ready, and that maybe some of our identity is a chance to let itself out, Vrabel said last week. Mission accomplished. May it be the first of many. Okay, let's turn to College Football Games to Watch by Eddie Tamanis. The first one he lists shows Ohio State at number 1 versus number 17, Illinois. They're playing at Illinois, and Ohio State, rather, is favored by 15.5 points. To Illinois' credit, the team got off the deck after what can only be described as a total beatdown at the hands of Indiana to win its next two games and stay in the top 25. The next assignment for the Fighting Illini, however, might cause feelings of deja vu if Ohio State continues to play like, well, Ohio State. Neither of the Buckeyes' first two Big Ten opponents have reached the end zone, but Illinois quarterback Luke Altmyer has 12 scoring throws, and running backs Khalil Valentine and Caden Feagan have combined for 8 rushing TDs. But meanwhile, Buckeyes quarterback Julian Sayin has only gotten better, with wide receivers Jeremiah Smith and Carnell Tate able to strike at any time. Prediction? Illinois will at least cross the goal line, but the Buckeyes will keep rolling. Ohio State 45-13. The next game is number 8 Alabama playing at Missouri, who's number 14. Alabama's favored by 3. Back in the top 10 and squarely in the SEC title hunt, the Crimson Tide hit the road to take on the unbeaten Tigers, whose non-conference win against Kansas last month might be more impressive than it appeared at the time. After keeping Vanderbilt's Diego Pavia in check, the Crimson Tide defense now turns its attention to Missouri quarterback Bo Pribula. But he could prove harder to contain thanks to the presence of his backfield mate, running back Ahmad Hardy, who is averaging a hefty 7.1 yards per carry. Alabama quarterback Ty Simpson is quite capable of keeping up in a track meet, though he was intercepted for the first time last week. Wide receiver Jeremy Bernard remains his most dependable weapon, and running back Jam Miller is rounding into form after battling an injury to start the season. Prediction? Mizzou has more offensive balance than Vandy and should be able to make a game of this. The home crowd will help, but in the end, the Tide will rise to the occasion. Alabama 38-30. Next is number 6 Oklahoma at number 19 Texas. Texas is favored by 3 in this game. Both teams enter Red River Week with questions, although the struggling Longhorns undeniably have more of them. Texas is still looking for consistency on offense, as quarterback Arch Manning has been inaccurate and the ground game struggles to find holes. That's a bad state of affairs as the Longhorns prepare to deal with defensive end Taylor Wine and the active Sooners defensive front. The Oklahoma offense will likely remain in the hands of backup quarterback Michael Hawkins, who got in a good tune-up start against lowly Kent State a week ago, but now faces a much greater degree of difficulty. Linebacker Anthony Hill Jr. and the Longhorns' defense must be ready, however, on the off chance that John Mateer returns from hand surgery ahead of schedule for the Sooners. Prediction: the defenses will likely control this one, which means a high likelihood the game will turn on a breakaway. That's rather a takeaway. That hasn't been a strong suit for the Sooners this year, but they will get one when they need it. Oklahoma 19-13. Next, we have number 7 Indiana at number 2 Oregon, with Oregon favored by 8.5 points. The Ducks return home for their second top 10 showdown in 3 weeks. The Hoosiers weren't quite as dominant at Iowa last week after crushing Illinois, but they got a taste of how to handle a tough road environment that could serve them well in Eugene. Indiana quarterback Fernando Mendoza wasn't at his best in Iowa City, but delivered the winning play when needed. He'll probably need to be sharper early on this week, although that's easier said than done against linebacker Mateo Uigalele and the rest of the Ducks' pass rushers. Oregon quarterback Dante Moore has 4 receivers with at least 15 catches. Hoosiers linebackers Isaiah Jones and Luis Moore will lead the effort to disrupt him. Prediction: Indiana is the real deal, but the Hoosiers would hardly be the first accomplished team to be unable to prevail in Autzen Stadium. It will take a while, but the Ducks will get control after intermission and hang on. Oregon 34-28. Next is number 15 Michigan at unranked Southern Cal. USC, however, is favored by 2.5 points. The Wolverines put their unblemished Big Ten record on the line as they venture out to the West Coast. The Trojans, already with a league loss on their ledger, are in need of a signature win to remain in the mix. Michigan quarterback Bryce Underwood remains a work in progress where his passing game is concerned, but he and running back Justice Haynes can break off big runs. The Trojans have been somewhat better in that area thanks to stoppers like linebacker Eric Gentry, but getting off the field on third down is still an issue. USC quarterback Jaden Maiava also gets solid ground support from running back Wayman Jordan, but not much gets by Wolverines linebacker Ernest Hausman. Prediction: traveling to the West Coast has been challenging for the Big Ten's old guard. The Wolverines will face a fired-up throng in the Coliseum, but their defense will eventually quiet them down. Michigan 23-16. Next, we have number 9 Georgia playing an unranked Auburn. And in this one, they have the spread listed as USC by 2.5. Somehow, I think that's not the right spread, but I can't fix it for you. Georgia got the bounce-back performance it needed last week after the Alabama loss. The Bulldogs now take the road to face a rested and desperate Tiger squad that needs a positive result after dropping their first two SEC contests by a total of 13 points. The defensive side of the ball has, for the most part, been sound for Auburn, and linebacker Xavier Adkins could again make life difficult for the Bulldogs quarterback Gunnar Stockton. The Tigers' offense has not performed well against SEC competition, as quarterback Jackson Arnold has been forced to scramble far too often. The good news for him is Georgia's pass rush hasn't been effective either, though linebacker Chris Cole brings heat on occasion from the second level. Prediction? Look for another shake-up of the polls from the Plains as the Tigers spring the upset. Auburn 20-17. And then we have Kansas at number 10, Texas Tech. Kansas is not ranked, and Texas Tech is therefore favored by 13.5 points. The Red Raiders couldn't have asked for a better start to their Big 12 campaign. Up next is a visit from the Jayhawks, who are fresh off a road win at Central Florida and now look to make an even bigger splash. Texas Tech quarterback Bayron Morton spreads the wealth among a deep array of targets led by wide receivers Coy Eakin and Caleb Douglas. No matter where he goes with the ball, expect to find Jayhawks linebacker Trey Lathan somewhere in the vicinity. KU will counter with quarterback Jalen Daniels, who can show off his wheels at times, but has let wide receiver Emmanuel Henderson and tight end Bowden Groen do most of the work downfield. You'll have to be aware of Red Raiders cornerback Bryce Pollock, who has already swiped three passes this season. Prediction? This Kansas team is good, having given Missouri all it could handle and coming up just a field goal short against Cincinnati a couple of weeks ago. But the Red Raiders are eyeing a special season and won't let the Jayhawks get in the way. Texas Tech, 41-24. Our last game, Arizona State ranked number 23rd playing at Utah, unranked. And Utah is favored by 5.5. The Sun Devils and the Utes now meet as Big 12 opponents in what could be a pivotal conference game. ASU prevailed in its first two conference contests by identical 27-24 scores, while Utah rebounded from a Texas Tech loss with a resounding road win against a rebuilding West Virginia. Quarterback Sam Leavitt to wide receiver Jaden Tyson remains the Sun Devils' most frequent big play combo, though ground support from running back Relik Brown will also be needed. They'll become well acquainted with Utah linebacker Jonathan Hall and safety Nate Ritchie. Utes quarterback Devin Dampier looks most often for wide receiver Ryan Davis and tight end Daylon Bentley. Opposing them will be ASU linebackers Jordan Crook and Keyshawn Elliott. Prediction? Let's have an old-fashioned late-night shootout to finish the weekend. The Utes will match scores with the Sun Devils into the wee hours, but ASU will pull it out to set up the next week's big home date against Texas Tech. Arizona State, 45-38. So now how about some college football overreactions from Eddie Thomas, who wrote this column. Week 6 in college football was pure gold for us here at Overreaction Headquarters, with fan bases and pundits all over the map experiencing peak elation, existential despair, and every emotion in between. Our job, of course, is to try and sort everything out. We'll go through the top 5 overreactions of the weekend with the goal of providing enough perspective to get a feel for whether these knee-jerk responses, justified or just one-week blips, that is, on a long season. So, whether you're feeling high in the sky or down in the dumps, take a deep breath. And let's delve into what we've just witnessed. Miami should be number 1. Big scoring plays from Carson Beck helped overcome a weak running game and gave number 3 Miami just enough of a buffer to beat number 19 Florida State 28-22. Beck went 20 of 27 for 240 yards and had 4 touchdowns, including a pair of scores from 40 and 44 yards to freshman receiver Malachi Toney. Ahead 28-3 after Beck hit C.J. Daniels from 24 yards out in the third quarter, the Hurricanes had to sweat things out after FSU made a field goal with 20 seconds left. While not a very strong performance overall, there was a stretch in the third quarter when Miami played elite football. We will concede that the Hurricanes at this moment have the best resume. Their conquest of the Sunshine State, along with the opening week triumph against Notre Dame, has more collective value than the results for the teams ranked ahead of them in the U.S. coaches poll, as Ohio State and Oregon saw their best wins depreciate in value over the weekend. More on those teams below. The Hurricanes need the teams they've beaten thus far to keep winning. However, as the rest of their schedule offers few opportunities for what might qualify as quality victories, while the Big Ten squads they're pursuing and the SEC clubs chasing them have many chances to move the Powerball, I'm sorry, the proverbial needle ahead of them, maybe also the Powerball. The polls are not considered by the playoff committee, and we're still a month away from getting a glimpse into their process with the release of their initial rankings. In short, talking about who should be number one is always fodder for debate, but it doesn't mean much with over half the season to go. But the UCLA result will be a constant anchor on their overall body of work, much in the way of a basketball bubble team with a quad four loss on the eve of March Madness. Trouble is, in football, there are fewer data points available to overcome a stain on the resume. Mathematically speaking, Penn State can run the table and get to 10-2. That would require wins at Ohio State and at home against Indiana, a tall order given the team's well-documented track record against top 10 teams under coach James Franklin. There's also always the treacherous trip to Iowa, and even a late home date with Nebraska could be iffy after what we saw from the Lions in the first half at the Rose Bowl. Just one more loss the rest of the way would put Penn State in a pool of other 9-3 at-large candidates. And it's unlikely its resume would stack up well against those others with the UCLA defeat and a lack of notable out-of-conference achievements to bolster it. So yes, it's probably not an overreaction to say that one was a season killer. Texas is cooked. The Longhorns would appear to be in similarly dire straits after their loss to Florida, in which Arch Manning had few answers and even the usually reliable defense couldn't shut down the struggling Gators. But Texas fans might have more reason for hope than Nittany Lions faithful. For one thing, it's possible that Florida might have more wins in it going forward, which would mitigate the damage to the Longhorns' body of work. We've also seen narratives turn on a dime in this sport from one week to the next. Should Texas find a way to topple Red River foe Oklahoma this week, the entire conversation changes. With that said, however, the Horns can probably afford no more than one more loss the rest of the way, and this team will need to show something we haven't seen yet to convince us a strong enough finish is in the cards. The remaining slate includes a trip to Georgia and a home finisher against Texas A&M, as well as a tricky date with Vanderbilt. Top 10 Texas Tech. With Iowa State falling from the ranks of the unbeaten at Cincinnati, Texas Tech now carries the banner as the highest-ranked squad from the Big 12, and as such, the de facto league favorite. But are the Red Raiders, that is, actually a top 10 team? At this early juncture in the league campaign, about the only answer we have for that question is maybe. We'll allow this much. At least the Red Raiders have looked the part. Texas Tech's pre-conference schedule was about as tissue soft as it could have been, but the Red Raiders handled their first two league assignments against then undefeated opponents, both on the road, with similar start-to-finish dominance. Houston's resume was also inflated, but Utah had begun the season by rolling UCLA, a result that is now not so easy to dismiss. In the end, we suppose, every pole position is earned, so Red Raider fans should enjoy the ride. Finally ranked, Memphis is the American favorite. With the season near the midpoint, the likelihood is high that the fifth automatic playoff qualifier will come from the American Conference. But the race to determine that league's champion is barely underway. Memphis, the defending conference champ, is at present the lone league member in the top 25. But the Tigers have plenty of company. Navy and North Texas also have unblemished records thus far, and South Florida and Tulane also picked up valuable wins against the so-called Power Four conferences in the first month. A true favorite in what should be a compelling race in the American is hard to identify until we start getting more head-to-head results. So stay tuned. Next, I'm going to turn to a couple of baseball stories. But before I'll do, I'll try and give a little update that's more current than this piece of paper I'm reading from. And that's because there are four division series being played today. And in the first of the games, the Detroit Tigers even their series with the Seattle Mariners by winning 9-3. And then the Cubs turned around and beat the Brewers 4-3. So those two series are tied up 2-2. The Yankees and Blue Jays game and the Dodgers and Phillies game are both still in progress as I'm recording this. So let's pay a little tribute to the Brewers and their success. I'll read from an article by Ted Rosiak of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. As one of the major players in the baseball renaissance of the Milwaukee Brewers, Christian Yelich has become accustomed to a familiar question. "We get this question every series," the designated hitter outfielder said. "How do you guys do it?" Matt Arnold, one of the architects as general manager, hears it a lot. "I get a pretty good amount," he says. "It's certainly flattering to hear it." Even team principal owner Mark Attanasio, as attuned as anyone to the notoriety, or at times lack thereof, the Brewers receive beyond the borders of Wisconsin, he's gotten used to it. "It's a popular question this year," he said. "For a long time now, we've been somewhat unnoticed. I used to joke with the national media that they didn't know we had Major League Baseball in Milwaukee until Labor Day." Well, Labor Day's come and gone, and here the plucky, hard-charging, and yes, small-market Brewers, they are here once again, bucking the odds as they closed out yet another incredible, successful season and play in the postseason. Actually, make that the most successful regular season in franchise history, putting up the best record in the major leagues, setting a franchise record for victories, and winning their third consecutive National League Central Division title. Pull the lens back further, and the Brewers' list of accomplishments grows. 7 postseason appearances in the past 8 years, and when they missed the playoffs in 2017 and 22, it was just by a single game each time. One of the 4 teams to qualify for the postseason in at least 7 of the past 8 seasons, joining the Dodgers, Astros, and Yankees. Totaled 763 victories through September 23rd, fourth most in the major leagues since 2017, behind only the Dodgers, Astros, and Yankees. Won 86 or more games in every full season since 2017, and joined only by the Dodgers and Astros. Won 90 or more games for a third straight season and fourth time in the past 5 seasons, also 2021. Up until 2021, the Brewers had reached the 90 victory mark 8 times in franchise history. And all of this with a payroll that's generally been in the bottom third of the 30 teams in the major leagues. Take this into consideration. As the calendar flipped to September, the Brewers' total payroll sat just shy of $113 million, according to SpotRac, a company which tracks payrolls and player contracts in several professional sports. The Dodgers sat just shy of $350 million with 12 players, making $10 million or more this season, led by Shohei Ohtani's salary of $46 million and change. So, how have the Brewers done it? And how do they continue to do it? Truth be told, there are many reasons. "It's not any one thing," Yelich says. "That's what everyone wants, this one secret thing like, oh wow, I never thought of it that way." It's not that. It's just a combination of a lot of stuff that leads to one big thing. Arnold's answer is much the same. "I guess I would just say that it's probably been a different formula every year," he said. "For our purposes, let's call it the 3 P's. First is people. At the heart of any successful organization is an experienced group of leaders who provide a strong, consistent foundation. The Brewers can certainly check all the boxes in that area. Attanasio has been the tip of the spear since 2005 when he and his ownership group officially assumed control of the franchise. Rick Schlesinger, now president of business operations, is in his 23rd season with the franchise. Marty Ronsky, the organization's chief operating officer, is in her 22nd season. Senior vice president of communications and affiliate operations, Tyler Barnes, is in his 20th season. It all starts with people, Attanasio said. And the fact is, do you Do you think about what an owner can do? I think of myself more as a steward for baseball here, and hopefully my family will be too for decades. But there's only so much you can do, right? I can't throw the ball. I can't hit the ball. You can set this tone and hire the right people. You think back to this and start with former general manager Doug Melvin. It was Melvin who in 2015 suggested to Attanasio that it might be time to consider firing Ron Renneke after the Brewers began the season 5-17 and bringing on then front office member Craig Counsell as manager, despite the fact that he'd never coached at any level. Later that season, when Melvin announced he'd be retiring, Attanasio brought on David Stearns and Arnold to lead baseball operations. That trio set about a teardown that was started by Melvin's deft trade line acquisition of eventual closer Josh Hader, and expected to last several seasons, that is, only to see the timeline accelerated when the Brewers finished just a game shy of the playoffs in 2017. Yelich and fellow outfielder Lorenzo Cain came aboard in 2018, and four straight playoff appearances followed. The 2022 season was kneecapped by the ill-contrived trade of Hader, and in October of that year, Stearns had stepped down, leading to Arnold's ascension to top baseball decision-maker. A year after that, it was Counsell who departed for the rival Chicago Cubs after his contract expired. Arnold hired Counsell's mentor and bench coach, Pat Murphy, and all he did was lead the Brewers to a Central Division title and win the NL's Manager of the Year award in his first season at the helm. They've shown even when people leave, they can figure out a way to sustain it, said San Francisco Giants general manager Zach Manassian, who spent 14 seasons in various capacities with the Brewers before leaving for his current role. And I think that's probably the most difficult thing to do in this industry. It's not necessarily to build a winner, but how do you build a sustainable winner, that is? Two of Arnold's top lieutenants, assistant general managers Carl Mueller and Matt Klein, have been with the franchise 22 and 19 seasons, respectively. Senior Vice President of Player Operations and Baseball Administration Tom Flanagan is in his 36th season after joining the Brewers as a bat boy in 1990. Vice President of Amateur Acquisition Todd Johnson is in his 18th season. Murphy is in his 10th season in the organization. Associate Manager Ricky Weeks goes back to 2003 as a player with the Brewers and is in his second season in his current role. Chris Hook is in his 18th season in the organization and 7th as a Major League pitching coach. Infield coach Matt Erickson joined in 2008 after first playing for the Brewers. Sensing a theme here? Our organization is like a family, Attanasio said. I believe in the systems we've built here, what we've tried to do to promote from within and to give people authority and try to put them in a position to succeed. The next P is processes. Take a look at the terrace level down the right field line at American Family Field, and the under-construction structure that's replaced sections of seating is to help house the team's ever-growing baseball operations department, which is roughly double the size it was when Stearns and Arnold assumed full control. It's such a massive operation now, Arnold said, way, way bigger than when it was 20 years ago, and that's when I got started. The number of departments has grown so much, and they're so much more complex. The Brewers certainly aren't alone in their expansion in this area. Numbers have come to rule every aspect of the game, whereas decades ago, most of what was done in terms of player acquisition and scouting relied upon the eyes test and opinions of longtime talent evaluators. Signings and trades are made based in part, largely, on what computer models show. Then it's up to the player development staff to help said players implement those changes, with the fine-tuning left to the coaches. In-game strategy is another huge focus, as is trying to stay ahead of the curve when it comes to technology. There's a high-performance staff that, among other duties, tracks the biometrics of players and then makes recommendations regarding playing time and days off. There's been a uniform member of the staff in the dugout every game for a number of years. This season, it's 25-year-old Evan Martin, whose role as a Major League game preparation specialist probably never could have been conceived of previously. Martin, who played baseball at Southern Illinois University, that means he's a Saluki for those of you who haven't heard that before, holds a master's degree in strategic analytics and a bachelor's degree in math. It's such a different game now, and the Brewers do it as well as any team in the ever-evolving era. The most tangible evidence of the Brewers' progress has come on the pitching side. Once regarded as an organization that excelled at developing hitters, Milwaukee has now made a habit of plucking pitchers off a scrap heap from other teams or out of independent leagues. The Brewers then turn the pitchers into viable contributors by identifying one particular pitch or an ability to spin the ball and drilling down on it with hook. Left-handed reliever Jared Koenig is probably the best example of this strategy on the current 26-man roster. He's in his second season of pitching in high-leverage situations out of the bullpen after being signed to a minor league deal following the 2023 season. Right-hander Quinn Priester has been a revelation since Milwaukee traded for him early in the season, but many questioned what the Brewers sent to Boston in exchange, highly regarded prospect Yofiri Rodriguez, considering the 24-year-old Priester's underwhelming resume to that point. I feel like, to an extent, we've become a destination for some guys that you want to get to, especially on the pitching side, Yelich said. I think that's a huge foundation for winning, right? You have to be good on the mound. If you're not good on the mound, then it's going to be hard for you to win. And we've been great at that the whole time I've been here. And it lets everything kind of slot into place because then your offense just kind of has a chance to win. The third P is players. Weeks wants to make one thing clear when asked for his opinion on Milwaukee's long-term success. It's player-driven. Let's get that out of the way first. I think in baseball in general, because of the information, you don't give players enough credit. They've got to go out there every day to play and win games. Indeed, thanks to much deft maneuvering on the player personnel front, the small market Brewers have churned out the 2018 NL MVP and 2019 MVP runner-up in Yelich, the 2020 NL Rookie of the Year in closer Devin Williams, the 2021 NL Cy Young Award winner in Corbin Burns, as well as multiple All-Stars such as starting pitchers Freddy Peralta and Brandon Woodruff. That's Woodruff. William Contreras, acquired in a trade in December of 22, is one of the best catchers in the game, and second baseman Bryce Terang, right fielder Sal Frelick, and right-hander Jacob Mizrowski, all Brewers draft picks, are budding stars. Milwaukee, always mindful of its purse strings, was able to lock Yelich into the richest contract in franchise history in March of 2020, one that pays him $26 million per year, but was club-friendly at the time. It also did the same with precocious Jackson Churio in December of 23, locking him into an 8-year, $82 million deal that could run as long as 10 years with club options. It was record-setting at the time for a player who'd yet to play in the majors. These deals, however, have been the exception and not the norm. The Brewers chose to trade Hader, Burns, and Williams a year before their price tags became too high as free agents. They also chose to hang on to shortstop Willie Adames last year because he was too important to that team to move and ended up with a first-round draft pick this July as compensation. We've had to make some tough decisions and some very tough trades. In some cases, we've elected not to make trades, and sometimes those trades that you don't make turn out to be the best, whether it's retaining some of your core players that we have on the field today or if it's keeping a guy like Adames. It spans the whole horizon. We're just trying to make good decisions, not just on their own, but throughout our process. It's a different soup every year. One final P, the postseason. And so it goes, with the postseason now looming and the Brewers eager to turn the page on their recent playoff failures, with no series victories at press time since the NL Division Series in 2018 and a brutally deflating exit against the Mets last season, looming large in everyone's mind. But for now, appreciate the fact they're back, yet again, against the odds, with their methodical, disciplined, and sometimes unorthodox recipe for success having built the foundation. I mean, do we have a choice? This is how we operate, Hook said. And I think part of that, too, is we're not looking for outside help. It's like this. These are the people we have. We trust our systems. We trust our processes. And we're going to go all in. We're not looking for outs. Burn the boat. I mean, we're not going back. I think maybe in other organizations, they may have somebody, it's not working, and they go get a replacement. That's not happening. Get in the boat. We're gone. Use the people we have, minor leagues, big leagues. And I think that tends to lift people up. This week's Sports Weekly includes a rather long story about the openings for baseball managers and the risks involved. But I don't think I'm going to cover all of that. I'm just going to cover the ones that pertain to the franchises in the Arizona Diamondbacks division. And the first among those, of course, is the Giants. The Giants have had just one winning season since 2017, a lower-tier farm system, an ownership that is desirous of winning, but whose outlay will still be dwarfed by the division rival Dodgers, and sometimes by the Padres. That they rank so high on this list speaks to the highly imperfect situations a prospective manager will inherit in 2026. Still, they're not far off with a 79 to 81 win seasons the past 4 years. They invested $182 million in shortstop Willy Adames and inherited more than $250 million in salary from the Rafael Devers trade. And both power-hitting infielders should be better acclimated to their pitcher-friendly park next season. The jury's still out on operations president Buster Posey, but he has at least proved to be aggressive and proactive. If the club opts not to reunite with Bruce Bochy, it will mark a clean break from the 2010s glory years that seemed to cast a shadow over former managers Gabe Kapler and, to a lesser extent, the recently fired Bob Melvin. In the other division, rival looking for a manager is the Colorado Rockies. They go for a disruptive change at Coors Field about as deftly as a tugboat makes a three-point turn. So don't be too surprised if young Warren Schaefer hangs on to the job full-time after a decent interim run in which the club lost only 119 games after trending towards smashing the White Sox's year-old mark of 121 losses. Still, the club did announce October 1st the departure of GM Bill Schmidt, who said in a statement released by the club that better seasons are ahead for the Rockies and our great fans, and I look forward to seeing it come to life in the years ahead. Yet, like the situation in Washington, the Rockies very much remain a family affair, and both the new baseball ops chief and manager would eventually run into the machinations of the Manfred clan. For the past 7 years, that means a record of 402 wins and 629 losses. Oh, and they still haven't figured out how to grow players to pitch at Coors Field. So I think I'll wrap things up with this is NFL Week 6 matchups. First, we have the Chargers at 3-2 playing the Dolphins at 1-4. The spread has the Chargers by 4.5. They play in Florida. The Patriots are playing the Saints. The Patriots are 3-2, and the Saints are 1-4. The betting line has the Patriots by 3.5. Then we have the Browns at 1-4 playing at the Steelers, who are 3-1. The betting line there is the Steelers by 5 points. Next, we have the Cowboys at 2-2-1 playing at the Panthers, who are 2-3. The betting line there is the Cowboys by 3.5. And then we have the Seahawks at 3-2 versus the Jaguars, who are also 3-2, having lost on Monday night. The spread has the Seahawks ahead by 1. Then we have the Rams at 3-2 versus the Ravens, who are only 1-4. The spread has the Rams by 7.5, and who can believe the Ravens are only 1-4? What a difficult year they've started with. Next, we have the Titans and the Raiders, both 1-4, playing in Las Vegas. And lo and behold, the Raiders are favored by 5 points. Then we have the Bengals at 2-3, playing the Packers at 2-1-1. They're playing, of course, in Green Bay, where the Packers are favored by 14.5 points. The 49ers at 4-1 are playing the Buccaneers, also at 4-1, should be a tight game. But the Buccaneers are currently favored by 3 points. Next, we have the Chiefs and the Lions playing. The Lions are playing at the Chiefs. The Lions are 4-1, and the Chiefs are 3-2, rather 2-3 now. And the Chiefs, playing at home, are favored by 1 point. Bills at 4-1 are playing the Falcons at 2-2. This is the Monday night game. The spread has the Bills up by 4. And the second Monday night game is the Bears playing at the Commanders. The Bears are 2-2. The Commanders are 3-2. And the spread has the Commanders ahead by 4.5 points. Well, it turns out I skipped a page, and so there are three more matchups in the pro game that I want to cover here. First, it's the Eagles at 4-1 playing the Giants at 1-4. This is the Thursday night game, and it's on Prime Video. And the spread has the Eagles favored by 7.5 points. And then we have the Broncos at 3-2 versus the Jets at 0-5. They're playing in London, and that game is also on Sunday, but it's at 9:30 in the morning. The Broncos are favored by 7.5. And I think this is the last game. The Cardinals, our Arizona Cardinals, at 2-3 are playing the Colts in Indianapolis at 4-1. And the Colts, of course, are favored by 6.5. Now here's a short snippet on the WNBA Finals. The Las Vegas Aces didn't just win Game 2 of the NBA Finals. They cut the heart and soul out of the Phoenix Mercury's title hopes. Whatever chance the Mercury had of winning the 2025 championship, or at least keeping the Aces honest, evaporated after the first quarter on Sunday at Michelob Ultra Arena in Las Vegas. Phoenix couldn't capitalize on its big leads. First 7 points and then 8, letting Las Vegas back in each time. Then the Aces' stars started cooking, and the Mercury had no answer. That second quarter, when Aja Wilson single-handedly outscored Phoenix. That third, when Jackie Young popped off for 21. That's how titles are won. When you get an edge on your opponent, you jam your foot on the gas, and you don't take it off. That's the goal, to not let up, Aces coach Becky Hamilton said after they took a 2-0 lead in the best-of-seven series with their 91-78 dismantling of Phoenix. You just don't want to have a satisfied locker room because we're not there yet, Hammond said. We did what we were supposed to do. And now I'm going to do what I'm supposed to do and sign off for this week. This is Kent Batty, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thank you for listening, and cheers to all you fans out there.